Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 943. The Galen Gang, the high-profile hacks, and the new Cold War. This is being recorded on January 19th of the year 2017. This program is going to exemplify why listeners to the program should use the SpitfireList.com website. They should subscribe to the comments that are being set forth by intelligent listeners and especially contributing editor Tara Fractal, and also some of the previous materials that are available. My entire life's work is available on the SpitfireList.com website for download for free. Please use it. Now, the title of this program refers to the operation developed by Reinhard Galen, last name G-E-H-L-E-N, a name well known to veteran listeners to the program. In a nutshell, summing up key points, Reinhard Galen was Hitler's chief of intelligence for the Eastern Front in World War II. He then, at the end of the war, jumped to the CIA, and his entire Eastern Front intelligence organization, at the end of the war under the control by the SS and Gestapo and Heinrich Himmler, and incorporating elements from the non-German Axis nations in Europe, including Bulgaria, Hungary, Romania, the Baltic states, and also key elements of the former Yugoslavia, especially Croatia. It jumped to the CIA while under the control of the German high command. Galen, before he jumped to the CIA, cleared his actions with Admiral Karl Dönitz, who had succeeded Hitler as chief or as head of state of Germany, and also with General Franz Halder, who had been his chief of staff. As we have seen in For the Record 305, the Galen organization also reported after the war to the NSDAP, the German Nazi Party in Exile, headed up by Reinhard Galen, and the German Interior Minister in Exile, who was Heinrich Müller, the head of the Gestapo. The Galen organization basically was described by former Marine Corps Colonel Robert Corson as, quote, a front for Odessa Nazis. That's what it was. Basically, the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs took its information from Hitler's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs. This was not something imposed from the outside, but it fit like a glove with the desires of American Cold Warriors, in particular elements of the GOP, and the defense industry. Under the auspices of the Crusade for Freedom, the Galen Gang then morphed into a key element of the Republican Party, the Republican Party's Ethnic Heritage Outreach Council. Eventually, the Galen organization became the de facto NATO intelligence organization, and finally the BND, the German Intelligence Service. And the current BND has long recruited from the families of BND members, BND officers, and has retained much of its Nazi character from the World War II period, as we looked at in For the Record 761. In this program, we're going to be taking a look at more information about the high-profile hacks, meaning specifically the hack into the DNC servers, the information then placed on WikiLeaks, the information, the hack into Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta's email account, the alleged hack into the NSA, which resulted in the posting of the ANT TAO tools on the internet. This does not appear to have been a hack at all, but rather the downloading of information onto a flash drive. that hack attributed, that non-hack, I should say, attributed to the, quote, shadow brokers, unquote, was accompanied by a laughable Boris and Natasha-like broken English text. And as we have looked at in For the Record 923, among others, it does not appear to have been a hack at all. And one of the chief suspects in that is Jacob Applebaum, who has received financing from the CIA, is an associate of WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. And like Julian Assange, was unabashedly anti-Clinton. The high-profile hacks have been a signal element in the new Cold War and in Russia / Kremlin / Putin bashing, and also in an Orwellian neo-McCarthyism that has labeled anyone willing to tell the truth about the re-emergence of Ukrainian fascism of the OUNB variety in Ukraine and the relevance of that to the new Cold War is, and also the high-profile hacks, I hope, will become present, as I will become apparent. As I've said before, things are so bad now that if Vladimir Putin were to say 2 + 2 = 4, our media and Western media in general would say that Russian propaganda has long asserted that 2 + 2 = 4, and this assertion has become a major element of Russian mathematical and arithmetical propaganda. Things are that bad. What we're going to do is to build on information presented in previous programs, primarily For the Record 917, 923, and 924, looking at the high-profile hacks and delving at greater length into information that was summarized by Sandro, S-A-N-D-R-O, Gaykin, or Gaykin, G-A-Y-C-K-E-N, a former hacktivist turned cyber consultant to NATO, the German Parliament, and the Council on Foreign Relations. Hardly someone one would tar as a leftist. In analysis that will be linked in the description to this program, Gaykin has pointed out that, in fact, the available information does not point to Russia at all, and the various pieces of technology used were not necessarily characteristic of Russia at all, but were available to anyone with access to the dark net. Furthermore, and perhaps more importantly, Gaykin has pointed out that the operational methodology used by the hackers in the hack of the DNC and the Podesta email account were not only not characteristic of the operational security or OPSEC that has been used by Russian hackers in the past, but are in direct contradiction of that methodology. We should also bear in mind that, as we have seen in For the Record 917 and 923, Roger Stone, a Republican Bertie Trix operative whose operations track all the way back to Richard Nixon's Bertie Trix operations in Watergate, was, by his account, in direct contact with Julian Assange of WikiLeaks, and Stone had been promising an October surprise leak from WikiLeaks. While we didn't have one great big downloading of information, one sort of informational hydrogen bomb, so to speak, from WikiLeaks, we did have the slow, steady leak of information from the DNC hack released on the eve of the Democratic National Convention, and also the Podesta email hack, which did indeed get put up more or less in October. Also, James Comey, head of the FBI, a Republican and Mitt Romney supporter in 2012, on the very eve of the election practically, dropped his legally questionable statement or his letter to Congress disclosing there was a new FBI investigation into Hillary Clinton. That made headlines. Turns out the investigation was just a rehash of an old investigation and arrived at no conclusions. If the train of illogic that we have seen, or the chain of illogic that we have seen so far, were to be applied to this, this would maintain that James Comey and the FBI are being manipulated, or actually agents of the Kremlin, agents of Russian subversion, operatives of Vladimir Putin. Of course, that is asinine. The rest of it is just as asinine as well. Please, please, please use the website and the written description for this program, because otherwise much of this may not make sense. Now, going back to the high-profile hacks, it turns out that as far as we can determine, the FBI still has not had access, or for months had no direct access to the DNC servers. At the epicenter of the whole Russia did it, Putin did it, Kremlin did it assertions about the high-profile hacks is a security outfit called CrowdStrike. That's capital CROWD, capital STRIKE. That is headed up by a guy named Dmitry, DMITRI, Alperovitch, or Alperovitch, Alperovitch. That is a nice Anglo-Saxon name, isn't it? Well, more about CrowdStrike and Dmitry Alperovitch, or Alperovitch, in the information to follow. But bear in mind, at the epicenter of the Russia did it, Putin did it, Kremlin did it, watch out, Russia is subverting our process, is CrowdStrike, although they are by no means alone. We'll get to more of that in a few minutes. Now, from Slate Magazine of January 6th of 2017, article by Ben Mathis Lilly, less than capital M-A-T-H-I-S hyphen capital L-I-L-L-E-Y. The declassified intelligence report on Russian hacking tells us very little we don't already know. And excerpting and skipping down, summing up. To summarize, the report says that the CIA, FBI, and National Security Agency believe that Russian hackers, directed ultimately by Vladimir Putin, hacked email accounts belonging to the Democratic National Committee and to Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta, and then passed the material they obtained on to WikiLeaks through a third party. This was done, the report asserts, because the Russians believed that Donald Trump would be friendlier to their country's interests as president than Hillary Clinton. And that's about it. Not counting info pages or appendices, the report is 5 pages long and does not include any description of the actual evidence that Russian actors were responsible for the DNC and Podesta hacks, an assertion that's supported by publicly available evidence analyzed by third parties, note that CrowdStrike being primary among them, or the assertion that Putin ultimately directed the release of hacked material in order to help elect Donald Trump, an assertion that's harder to verify independently. Bear in mind that Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden, or the Peach Fuzz Fascist, or as I have termed him, the Obverse Oswald, has endorsed the version, or the meme really is what it is, that Russia was behind the hacks. And even though he would have known better, he endorsed the untenable hypothesis that the shadow brokers non-hack, with its ridiculous broken Russian Boris and Natasha-like accompanying text, was also done by Russia. Bear in mind that when Citizen Snowden decided to embark upon his escapades, he was working for the CIA in 2009. I've termed Snowden the Obverse Oswald more and more this looks to me like almost in certain important respects a strategic reworking of the assassination of JFK. We were told, yep, Oswald did it, and yet there was the hint that maybe it was Russia, maybe it was Cuba. And none of the relevant documentation was released, at least not the things that we needed to see. Recently, a lot of information in the last couple of decades has been released, thanks largely to the efforts of Oliver Stone and his JFK movie. In For the Record 925 and For the Record 926, I reviewed information from the archives about painting Oswald red, and that is relevant in the context of the high-profile hacks.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
The available information suggests overwhelmingly that the hacks were a false flag operation performed by party or parties unknown, perhaps private hackers, but certainly the situation is such that it looks like a false flag operation, and a layperson was being set up to accept the version that, yep, Russia did it. From the Vice motherboard of October 30th of 2016, an article by Lorenzo Franceschi Bicchirai, that's Francescii, How Hackers Broke Into John Podesta and Colin Powell's Gmail Accounts. And I would take that with an enormous, not a grain of salt, with an entire salt mine. Skipping down. The technology here is something called Bitly, B-I-T-L-Y. Skipping down. Using Bitly allowed, quote, third parties to see their entire campaign, including all their targets, something you'd want to keep secret, unquote, Tom Finney, a researcher at SecureWorks, told Motherboard. It was one of Fancy Bear's, quote, greatest mistakes, unquote, as Thomas Ridd, R.I.D., a professor at King's College who has closely studied the case, put it in a new piece published on Thursday in Esquire, as it, name of the use of Bitly, gave researchers unprecedented visibility into the activities of Fancy Bear, linking different parts of its larger campaign together. And again, that does not sound like something that would be done by a professional intelligence service and is in direct contravention of the traditional operational security surrounding Russian hacking, as we have seen in the Sandro Gaken piece, which will be excerpted and linked in the description to this program. Noting something else. From CBS News of October 28th of 2016, the phishing, that's PH, phishing email that hacked the account of John Podesta. Skipping down and excerpting, the email with the subject line, someone has your password, unquote, greeted Podesta. Hi, John, and then said, someone has just used your password to try to sign into your Google account, johnpodesta@gmail.com. Then it offered a timestamp and an IP address in location Ukraine, unquote. Now, hacking, one of the things about hacking is that it should be noted, a skilled hacker can go to great lengths to successfully mask the origin of the hack. This does not mean that it was Ukraine, however, that is something we certainly have to entertain seriously in light of information that we will be reviewed and presented below. Fascinating details coming from the BuzzFeed blog of January 4th of 2017 by Ali, A-L-I, Watkins. The FBI never asked for access to hacked computer servers, unquote. excerpting. 6 months after the FBI first said it was investigating the hack of the Democratic National Committee's computer network, the Bureau still has not requested access to the hacked servers, a Democratic National Committee spokesman said. No U.S. government entity has run an independent forensic analysis on the system, one U.S. intelligence official told BuzzFeed News. The FBI has instead relied on computer forensics from a third-party tech security company, CrowdStrike, which first determined in May of last year that the DNC's servers had been infiltrated by Russia-linked hackers, the U.S. intelligence official told BuzzFeed News. Quote, CrowdStrike is pretty good. There's no reason to believe that anything that they have concluded is not accurate, the intelligence official said. Of course, speaking on condition of anonymity, resuming, adding that they were confident Russia was behind the widespread hacks. It's unclear why the FBI didn't request access to the DNC servers, and whether it's common practice when the Bureau investigates the cyber attacks against private entities by state actors, like when the Sony Corporation was hacked by North Korea in 2014. BuzzFeed News spoke to three cybersecurity companies who have worked on major breaches in the last 15 months who said that it was, quote, par for the course, unquote, for the FBI to do their own forensic research into the hacks. Apparently, that was not done here. None wanted to comment on the record on another cybersecurity company's work or the record or the work being done by a national security agency. Now, that doesn't sound very convincing, does it? The FBI, it turns out, is blaming this on the DNC. Also by Ali Watkins, also from BuzzFeed, this from January 5th of 2017. The FBI now says Democrats were behind hack investigation delay. Excerpting. The FBI struck back at the DNC on Thursday, accusing it of denying federal investigators access to its computer systems and hamstringing its investigation into the infiltration of DNC servers by Russia-backed hackers. Quote, the FBI repeatedly stressed to DNC officials the necessity of obtaining direct access to servers and data, only to be rebuffed until well after the initial compromise had been mitigated. This left the FBI no choice but to rely upon a third party for information, a senior law enforcement official told BuzzFeed News in a statement, again quoting, these actions caused significant delays and inhibited the FBI from addressing the intrusion earlier. The warring statements are the latest twists in an extraordinary standoff between the Democrats and federal investigators that reached a fever pitch over the Bureau's probe into Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton's private email server. Skipping down. The FBI announced it was investigating the hack of the DNC's servers in July after a third-party computer security firm, CrowdStrike, said it had evidence of Kremlin-backed hackers infiltrating its system. And also from BuzzFeed News, this from yet another day later, January 6th of this year, also by Ali Watkins. DNC, that fight with the FBI over hacked servers, was all a misunderstanding. Excerpting. The FBI had previously told lawmakers on the Hill that the DNC had not allowed federal investigators to access their servers. After BuzzFeed News reported on Wednesday that the DNC claimed FBI agents had never asked for the servers in the first place, congressional officials pressed the FBI for answers. A senior law enforcement official issued a public statement on the matter Thursday night, someone is lying their A blank blank off, a U.S. intelligence official said of the warring statements. But officials with the DNC still assert they, quote, cooperated with the FBI 150%. They've had access to anything they want, anything they desire, anything they've asked, we've cooperated, the DNC official said. If anybody contradicts that, it's between CrowdStrike and the FBI. And skipping down. Without direct access to the computer network, another U.S. intelligence official told BuzzFeed, federal investigators had been forced to rely on the findings of the private cybersecurity firm CrowdStrike for computer forensics. From May through August of 2016, the Democratic National Committee paid CrowdStrike $267,807 for maintenance, data services, and consulting, among other things, according to federal records. So, again, it is highly unusual for the FBI not to gain direct access to the servers, which they apparently did not do, and they are, as it appears, scapegoating the DNC.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
And next, we're going to take a look at a very important article, this one from The Nation magazine of January 3rd of 2017, this by James Carden, C-A-R-D-E-N. And in this, we are going to get into not only some of the skepticism that has been voiced by other cybersecurity experts, but also why I have turned the titled this program, The Galen Gang, The High Profile Hacks, and the New Cold War. Excerpting James Carden's article, it's called, Is Skepticism Treason? And it reads in part, and the description to this program contains much more text and entire linked and excerpted articles that will not appear in this program because they have appeared in previous shows and we only have so much time. And again, from this, the James Carden article, Is Skepticism Treason? Yet despite the scores of breathless media pieces that assert that Russia's interference in the election is, quote, case closed, unquote, might some skepticism be in order? Some cybersecurity experts say yes. Cybersecurity experts have also weighed in. Skipping down, cybersecurity experts have also weighed in. The security editor at Ars Technica observed that, quote, instead of providing smoking guns that the Russian government was behind specific hacks, the government report, quote, largely restates previous private sector claims without providing any support for their validity. Robert M. Lee, of the cybersecurity company Dragos, D-R-I-G-O-S, noted that the report, quoting, reads like a poorly done vendor intelligence report stringing together various aspects of attributions without evidence, unquote. Cybersecurity consultant Jeffrey Carr, C-A-R-R, noted that the report merely listed every threat group ever reported on by a commercial cybersecurity company that is suspected of being Russian-made and lumped them under the heading of Russian Intelligence Service, or RIS, without providing any supporting evidence that such a connection exists, unquote. In this respect, It is worth noting that one of the commercial cybersecurity companies the government has relied on is CrowdStrike, which was one of the companies initially brought in by the DNC to investigate the hacks, the alleged hacks, unquote. And skipping down. Bear in mind again what I said about Dmitry Alperovitch, or Alperovitch, Alperovitch. More about him is noted here. Dmitry Alperovitch, or Alperovitch, is also a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. Skipping down. The connection between CrowdStrike co-founder and chief technology officer Dmitry Alperovitch and the Atlantic Council has gone largely unremarked upon, but it is relevant given that the Atlantic Council, which is funded in part, now check this out, it is relevant given that the Atlantic Council, which is funded in part by the U.S. State Department, NATO, the governments of Latvia and Lithuania, the Ukrainian World Congress, and the Ukrainian oligarch Viktor Pinchuk, P-I-N-C-H-U-K, has been among the loudest voices calling for a new Cold War with Russia. As I pointed out in the pages of The Nation in November, the Atlantic Council has spent the past several years producing some of the most virulent specimens of the new Cold War propaganda. Basically, it is CrowdStrike, headed up by Dmitry Alperovitch, that is the main source here for these allegations. And again, the Atlantic Council, which is funded in part by the U.S. State Department, NATO, the governments of Latvia and Lithuania, the Ukrainian World Congress, and the Ukrainian oligarch Viktor Pinchuk, has been among the loudest voices calling for a new Cold War with Russia. As I pointed out in the pages of The Nation in November, the Atlantic Council has spent the past several years producing some of the most virulent specimens of the new Cold War propaganda. Basically, that is the milieu of the Galen Gang. Latvia and Lithuania are two of the Baltic states very closely connected to the Third Reich. Lithuania was actually the second European country to go fascist in 1926 after Mussolini's Italy. And the Baltic states, the Ukrainian World Congress, is inextricably linked with the OUNB milieu, as is Ukrainian oligarch Viktor Pinchuk. Now, I'm going to put links in the description and excerpts. There was a very important article that we dealt with in past programs from alternet.org from December 7th of 2016 by the formidable Mark Ames, A-M-E-S. The anonymous blacklist quoted by the Washington Post has apparent ties to Ukrainian fascism and CIA spying. And this talks about the Prop or Not website that was the source for a now widely discredited article in the Washington Post, labeling all sorts of websites and media outlets as tools of Russian intelligence, blah, 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 blah. It now turns out that Prop or Not is very closely connected to the OUNB milieu that is now in power in Ukraine. And again, excerpts of the article, links to the article, and links to previous programs talking about the Prop or Not group, and that, and including the Mark Ames article, will be in the written description for the program. Also noting the following, and this is worth noting from that same article. One of the key media sources who blamed the DNC hacks on Russia, ramping up fears of crypto-Putinist infiltration, is a Ukrainian-American lobbyist working for the DNC. She is Alexandra Chalupa, C-H-A-L-U-P-A, described as the head of the Democratic National Committee's opposition research on Russia and on Trump, and founder and president of the Ukrainian lobby group U.S. United with Ukraine Coalition, which lobbied hard to pass a 2014 bill increasing loans and military aid to Ukraine, imposing sanctions on Russians, and tightly aligning the U.S. and Ukraine geostrategic interests, skipping down. In one leaked DNC email earlier this year, Chalupa boasts to the DNC communications director Luis Miranda that she brought Michael Isikoff to a U.S. government-sponsored Washington event featuring 68 Ukrainian journalists, where Chalupa was invited, quote, to speak specifically about Paul Manafort, unquote. That, again, from the Mark Ames Alternet article. The point being that at the Democratic side, there are people who have been OUNB, in fact, almost certainly OUNB milieu infiltration of the Democratic Party. And when there is Trump allied with Russia, et cetera, came out, it would have been absolutely natural for the Democratic National Committee to conduct what is known as opposition research on Trump and Paul Manafort. I think the DNC, in fact, no, I know the DNC was being gamed, and who should ride to the, not rescue, but to the execution, Alexandra Chalupa. And recapping again this brief excerpt, in turn, Michael Isikoff named her as the key inside source proving that the Russians were behind the hacks and that Trump's campaign was under the spell of Kremlin spies and sorcerers. It would not surprise me if she also was the person who effected the introduction of CrowdStrike to the DNC. CrowdStrike being headed up by someone, Dmitry Alperovich, who is inextricably linked to the Atlantic Council, one of its senior fellows, which is in turn funded by the Galen Gang, in addition to the State Department and NATO, Latvia, Lithuania, the Ukrainian World Congress, and Ukrainian oligarch Viktor Pinchuk. Now, in the article that we have accessed in the past by Sandro Gaken, he noted that Fancy Bear and Cozy Bear, alleged Russian hackers, have also been blamed for a hack into the German Parliament. That parliament, the Bundestag, also resulted in a bunch of documents being leaked to WikiLeaks, just like the DNC and John Podesta. However, it now turns out that apparently the quote hack unquote was not actually the source for the documents, but that it was an insider in the Bundestag leaking the relevant documents, which then, just like the DNC and Podesta information, wound up on WikiLeaks. Bear in mind, not only is Julian Assange and WikiLeaks part of the alt-right milieu linked to David Duke and others, as we have seen in numerous For the Record programs that will be linked, but one of the key figures, a guy named Joran Jermas, a.k.a. Israel Shamir, is part of a Russian and Ukrainian fascist milieu that networks with David Duke, and he is in charge of WikiLeaks operations vis-a-vis Russia and the former Soviet Union. His son, Johannes Wallström, a bird of the same political feather, is in charge of WikiLeaks operations with regard to Scandinavia. Now, from the Frankfurter Allgemeine Politik, that is a section of the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, Germany's leading daily, from December 17th to 2016. What I'm going to note here, this is the very rough Google translation of the article, and I'm not going to inflict Google's rough translation upon you. I will simply note that The title is WikiLeaks Source for Revelations in the Bundestag Suspects, plural. Again, classic Google, quote, translation, unquote. What this points out, however, is that according to the report, federal security authorities are convinced that hackers hadn't stolen the 2,420 documents published by the internet platform WikiLeaks in early December. There was certainly no evidence that the material had been stolen in the cyber attack on the Bundestag. And then, quote, the Mirror, unquote, pointed out that the WikiLeaks material covered 90 gigabytes, but the infiltrated Bundestag material only 16 gigabytes. The cyber attacks apparently were not from WikiLeaks, but from a, and I'm paraphrasing here to spare you the Google translation, but it appears that it was an insider who leaked the information to WikiLeaks.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Now, more information here. And this I'm going to stretch out. There is an excellent article that appeared in the publication that normally does not feature such rigorous scholarship, that is Counterpunch, from January 13th to 2017. This is by Gregory Elich, E-L-I-C-H. Did the Russians really hack the DNC? Question mark. Now, this points out a number of things. First of all, Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear are two names that have been applied to something known as APT-28 and APT-29. Now, that is code word, or that is an abbreviation for Advanced Persistent Threat 28 and Advanced Persistent Threat 29. It is not at all clear that these are even separate entities. And these are the entities that hacked into the German parliament and that hacked into the DNC. And as we are going to see, first of all, and we should note, there may have been Russian hacks into the parliament and to the DNC. It would not surprise me if there were. However, they would have been done much more skillfully than these. And those would have been, in all probability, for the gathering of intelligence. However, there are many, many problems with the APT-28 and APT-29. Again, from Counterpunch by Gregory Elich, did the Russians really hack the DNC? Skipping down. Each of the two intrusions acted as an advanced persistent threat, which is an attack that resides undetected on a network for a long time. The goal of an APT is to exfiltrate data from the infected system rather than inflict damage. Several names have been given to these two actors, and most commonly Fancy Bear, known as APT-28, and Cozy Bear as APT-29. The fact that many of the techniques used in the hack resembled in varying degrees past attacks attributed to Russia may not necessarily carry as much significance as we are led to believe. Once malware is deployed, it tends to be picked up by cyber criminals and offered for sale or trade on deep web black markets where anyone can purchase it. Exploit kits are especially popular sellers, excuse me, being again exploit kits, are especially popular sellers. Quite often, the code is modified for specific uses. Security specialist Josh Pitts, P-I-T-T-S, demonstrated how easy that process can be, downloading and modifying 9 samples of the Onion Duke malware, which is thought to have first originated with the Russian government. Pitts, P-I-T-T-S, reports that this exercise demonstrates, quote, how easy it is to repurpose nation-state code malware. Attribution is hard, cybersecurity specialists often point out. Once an APT is released into the wild, its spread isn't controlled by the attackers, unquote, writes Mark McArdle, again quoting, they can't prevent someone from analyzing it and repurposing it for their own needs. Adapting malware is, quote, a well-known reality, he continues. Finding irrefutable evidence that links an attacker to an attack is virtually unattainable, as everything boils down to assumptions and judgments. Security Alliance regards security firm FireEye's analysis that tied APT-28 to the Russian government as based, quote, largely on circumstantial evidence, unquote. FireEye's report, quote, explicitly disregards targets that do not seem to indicate sponsorship by a nation state. That again. FireEye's report explicitly disregards targets that do not seem to indicate sponsorship by a nation state, having excluded various targets because they are, quote, not particularly indicative of a specific sponsor's interests, unquote. FireEye reported that the APT-28, quote, victim set is narrow, unquote, which helped lead it to the conclusion that it is a Russian operation. Cybersecurity consultant Jeffrey Carr reacts with scorn. The victim set is narrow because the report's authors make it narrow. In fact, it wasn't narrowly targeted at all if you take into account the targets mentioned by other cybersecurity companies, not to mention those that FireEye deliberately excluded for being, quote, not particularly indicative of a specific sponsor's interests, unquote. FireEye's report from 2014, on which much of the DNC attribution is based, found that 89% of the APT-28 software samples it analyzed were compiled during regular working hours in St. Petersburg and Moscow. But compile times, like language settings, can be easily altered to mislead investigators. Mark McArdle wonders, quote, if we think about the very high level of design engineering and testing that would be required for such a sophisticated attack, is it reasonable to assume that the attacker would leave these kinds of breadcrumbs? It's possible, but it's also possible that these things can be used to misdirect attention to a different party, potentially another adversary. Is this evidence the result of sloppiness or a careful misdirection? If these guys are really good, says Chris Finan, F-I-N-A-N, CEO of Manifold Technology, they're not leaving much evidence. They're leaving evidence to throw you off the scent entirely. How plausible is it that Russian intelligence services would fail even to attempt such a fundamental step, skipping down. In the PDF file that Lucifer 2.0 sent to Gawker.com, that's the same alleged Russian culprits, metadata indicated that it was last saved by someone having a username in Cyrillic letters. During the conversion of the file from Microsoft Word to PDF, invalid hyperlink error messages were automatically generated in the Russian language. This would seem to present rather damning evidence, but who is Lucifer 2.0? A Russian government operation, a private group, or a lone hacktivist? In the poorly secured DMC system, there were almost certainly many infiltrators of various stripes. Nor can it be ruled out that the metadata indicators were intentionally generated in the file to misdirect attribution. The two APT attacks have been noted for their sophistication, and these mistakes, if that is what they are, seem amateurish. To change the language setting on the computer can be done in a matter of seconds, and that will be standard procedure for advanced cyber warriors. On the other hand, sloppiness on the part of developers is not entirely unknown. However, one would expect a nation state to enforce strict software and document handling procedures and implement rigorous review processes. Skipping down again. APT relied on XTunnel, repurposed from open source code that is available to anyone, to open network parts and siphon data. The interesting thing about the software is its failure to match the level of sophistication claimed for APT-28. The strings in the code quite transparently indicate its intent, with no attempt at obfuscation. It seems an odd oversight for a nation-state operation in which plausible deniability would be essential to overlook that glaring point during software development. Command and control servers remotely issue malicious commands to infected machines. Oddly, for such a key component of the operation, the command and control IP addresses in both attacks were hard-coded in the malware. This seems like another inexplicable choice, given that the point of an advanced persistent threat is to operate for an extended period without detection. A more suitable approach would be to use a domain name system or DNS address, which is a decentralized computer naming system. That would provide a more covert means of identifying the command and control server. Moreover, one would expect that address to be encrypted. Using a DNS address would also allow the command and control operation to easily move to another server if one of the IP addresses is claimed to be a well-known APT-28 command and control address, while the second is said to be linked to Russian military intelligence. The first address points to a server located in San Jose, California, and is operated by a server hosting service. The second, and then there's a misprint here, it doesn't talk about the second server. Clearly, these are servers that have been compromised by hackers. It is customary for hackers to route their attacks through vulnerable computers. The IP addresses of compromised computers are widely available on the deep web, and typically a hacked server will be used by multiple threat actors. These two particular servers may or may not have been regularly utilized by Russian intelligence, but they were not uniquely so used. Almost certainly, many other hackers would have used the same machines, and it cannot be said that these IP addresses uniquely identify an infiltrator. Indeed, the second IP address is associated with the common Trojan viruses Agent, APPR, and Shunail. Everyone is focused on attribution, but we may be missing the bigger truth, says Joshua Croman, C-R-O-M-A-N, director of the Cyber Statecraft Initiative at the Atlantic Council. Well, thank God for small favors. The level of sophistication required to do this hack was so low that nearly anyone could do it, skipping down. Security expert Jeffrey Carr explains, once malware is deployed, it is no longer under the control of the hacker who deployed it or the developer who created it. It can be reverse engineered, copied, modified, shared, and redeployed again and again by anyone, unquote. Carr quotes security firm ESET in regard to the SEDNIT, S-E-D-N-I-T, capital S-E-D-N-I-T group. One of the items on the report's list, and which is another name for APT-28. Quote, as security researchers, what we call the SEDNIT group is merely a set of software and the related infrastructure which we can hardly correlate with any specific organization, unquote. Carr points out that X-Agent software, which is said to have been utilized in the DNC hack, was easily obtained by ESET for analysis. Quote, if ESET could do it, so can others. It is both foolish and baseless to claim, as CrowdStrike does, that X Agent is used solely by the Russian government when the source code is there for anyone to find and use at will. Skipping down again. Cybersecurity analyst Robert Graham was particularly blistering in his assessment of the government's report, characterizing it as full of garbage, unquote. The report fails to provide the indicators of compromise to the Russian government. Quote, it contains signatures of viruses that are publicly available, used by hackers around the world, not just Russia. It contains a long list of IP addresses from perfectly normal services like Tor, Google, Dropbox, Yahoo, and so forth. Yes, hackers use Yahoo for phishing and maladvertising. It doesn't mean every access of Yahoo is an indicator of compromise, unquote. Graham compared the list of IP addresses against those accessed by his web browser and found two matches. No, he continues, this doesn't mean I've been hacked. It means I just had a normal interaction with Yahoo. It means the grisly step IOCs are garbage, unquote. Graham goes on to point out that what really happened, unquote, with a supposed Russian hack into the Vermont power grid, quote, is that somebody just checked their Yahoo email, thereby accessing one of the same IP addresses I access, skipping down. The indicators of compromise in Graham's assessment were, quote, published as a political tool to prove they have evidence pointing to Russia, unquote. As for the PAS web shell, it is, quote, used by hundreds, if not thousands, of hackers, mostly associated with Russia, but also throughout the rest of the world. Relying on the government's sample for attribution is problematic, and then quoting, just because you found PAS in two different places doesn't mean it's the same hackers. And again, in a Consortium News article that we have accessed, former UK diplomat Craig Murray asserts that he got the information from an unidentified, dissatisfied DNC insider, and he gave it to WikiLeaks. We wonder if that might have been Tulsi Gabbard, closely connected at one level, in fact, one of the driving forces behind the Bernie Sanders campaign, and also someone linked to an element of the Hare Krishna cult, Indian fascism, and who knows, perhaps a mind control job, wrapping things up. The new Cold War is underway, and a terrifying feature was signed into law by Barack Obama. From the Consortium News website of January 1st of 2017, an article by Rick Sterling, S-T-E-R-L-I-N-G, the war against alternative information. And this is chilling indeed. Here it comes, folks. The U.S. establishment is not content to simply have domination over the media narratives on critical foreign policy issues such as Syria, Ukraine, and Russia. It wants total domination. Thus, we now have the Countering Foreign Propaganda and Disinformation Act that President Obama signed into law on December 23rd as part of the National Defense Authorization Act for 2017, setting aside $160 million to combat any propaganda, unquote, that challenges official Washington's version of reality. The new law mandates the U.S. Secretary of State to collaborate with the Secretary of Defense, Director of National Intelligence, and other federal agencies to create a global engagement center, quote, to lead, synchronize, and coordinate efforts of the federal government to recognize, understand, expose, and counter foreign state and non-state propaganda and disinformation efforts aimed at undermining United States' national security interests, unquote. The law mandates the center to be formed in 180 days and to share expertise among agencies and to coordinate with allied nations, unquote. And it then references the supposed Putin hacks as reason for this. And skipping down, the new law is remarkable for a number of reasons, not the least because it merges a new McCarthyism about purported dissemination of Russian propaganda on the Internet with a new Orwellianism by creating a kind of Ministry of Truth or Global Engagement Center to protect the American people from, quote, foreign propaganda and disinformation, unquote. Watch out, people. Here it comes. This concludes For the Record program number 943, the Galen Gang, the high-profile hacks, and the new Cold War, being recorded on January 19th of the year 2017. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.